Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take a stack of your sources, articles, research, our notes, and, well, we pull out the most important bits of knowledge and insight. Think of it as your shortcut, really, to being properly informed. We try to find those surprising facts, maybe add just enough humor to keep you, hooked. Today, we're embarking on a really fascinating deep dive. We're looking at early Islamic history, issues from the 6th, 7th centuries in the works of Azerbaijani researchers. It's a remarkable piece from the Azerbaijani National Academy of Sciences.
Yeah, and it's not just a, another history book. What's really insightful here is how it pulls together research by Azerbaijani scholars, and then it carefully compares that with Arabic language works. So you get this unique, often overlooked perspective on what was a really pivotal period.
Absolutely. So our mission today is to unpack those formative years of Islam. We're talking from Prophet Muhammad's early life right through to the Rashidun Caliphs, and explore the huge social, political, spiritual changes that basically shaped a whole civilization. Get ready for some, profound insights and maybe a few surprising facts about this foundational era. Okay, so to really appreciate how dynamic Islam's emergence was, we first need to kind of paint a picture of the world it arrived in, pre-Islamic Arabia. Our source describes it as a society, mostly these diverse tribal groups, largely Bedouin Arabs, living under what were basically primitive communal structures, led by sheikhs, elders, that sort of thing. It's often called the era of jahiliyyah, or ignorance, right? Mm. But what's interesting is, despite the conflicts, the source points out positive values were there. Kindness, humanity, honor, sticking to agreements. Can maybe unpack that a bit?
That's a really crucial point, because jahiliyyah often sounds like, a total moral vacuum. But the work highlights this period wasn't empty of a strong ethical code, especially within those tribal loyalties. Things like protecting the weak, fulfilling your oaths, generous hospitality. These were deeply ingrained values, even with all the intertribal fighting. And talking about origins, it's fascinating that Arab itself, the word, it initially meant something geographical, not ethnic, like dry, raw land.
It was only later, after Islam unified people in the 7th century, that it came to mean this large, unified group.
That's a huge shift in identity. And the religious landscape, it wasn't simple either, was it? You had widespread polytheism, idol worship everywhere, idols like Hubal, Alat, Aluza, Manat, even inside the Kaaba itself. But the sources also mention the Hanifs. These were followers of Abraham and Ishmael, monotheists pushing the idea of one God. Plus, you had Jewish and Christian communities already there bringing their faith through, like trade routes and settlements. Yes, exactly. The existing religious mix and the sort of underlying monotheistic ideas, that's really crucial context. It means Islam's message didn't just land in a vacuum. It landed in a complex spiritual environment, and that definitely shaped how it was received.
And into this complex world, Prophet Muhammad was born, 570 AD, the famous Year of the Elephant in Mecca. His grandfather, Abd al-Muttalib, gave him the name Muhammad. He had a tough start, an orphaned childhood, raised first by his grandfather, then his uncle Abu Talib. His marriage to Khadija when he was 25, that really stands out, doesn't it?
It really does. Khadija was, around 40? She'd been married twice, had children already. But their marriage, 25 years, it was based on this deep love and mutual respect. And a key detail the work emphasizes is he took no other wives while she was alive. That says a lot about their bond.
Then came that pivotal moment, the first revelation, the call to monotheism, age 40, 610 AD, during Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad receives the first revelation from Gabriel, the first five verses of Surah Al-Alaq, and this kicked off his divine mission, present one all-powerful God to this fragmented society.
And this guidance, it wasn't just dropped on them all at once. The Quran, as our source points out, it was revealed gradually, over 23 years. This slow unveiling, it allowed people to understand it better, to memorize it, and crucially, it gave flexibility. It could adapt to, training hearts spiritually, but also the practical side of governing people as things developed. It feels more dynamic, less like a static rule book just handed down.
Mm-hmm. But not everyone was happy about this new message, obviously. Mm-hmm. Early opposition, persecution in Mecca was severe. The Quraysh leaders, they really pushed back hard. They saw Islam as a direct threat to their traditions, their power, their economic interests tied to the Kaaba idols. Mm-hmm. People like Abu Lahab, Abu Jahl, Abu Sufyan, they were major opponents.
And the persecution was brutal. The work mentions weaker Muslims, like Bilal, facing terrible torture. This forced people to leave for safety. First, a small group, 11 men, 4 women, went to Abyssinia in 614 AD, seeking refuge with the ruler there, Najashi, who was known to be just. Then a bigger group followed a year later. It really shows you the incredible strength and faith of those early believers facing such hardship.
Right. And this intense pressure eventually led to that big strategic move, the Hijra, the migration to Medina. After 13 years trying to spread the message in Mecca, it had really taken root in Yathrib, which would soon be called Medina. The Ad and Khazraj tribes there, they'd embraced Islam and pledged support to the Prophet. How big a deal was that invitation from Yathrib?
Oh, it was a total game changer. The work points to this key moment. 73 women and 2 men from Yathrib met the Prophet at Aqaba, and they pledged to protect him like their own family, their own honor. That level of commitment from outside Mecca, that signaled a massive shift. The Quraysh saw this happening, this growing strength, and that's when they plotted to assassinate the Prophet, which in turn pushed him to leave Mecca secretly.
So the Hijra, the migration to Yathrib, soon to be Medina, 622 AD, the Prophet was 53, he went after his followers. And the source really stresses this wasn't just moving house. It was a profound turning point. It shifted his religious call into a whole new gear. He wasn't just a man receiving visions anymore.
Exactly. In Medina, his role just exploded. He became a commander, a wise statesman, the organizer of this rapidly growing Muslim community. This wasn't just about leadership changing. It was about the nature of the whole Islamic movement changing, laying the groundwork for an actual state.
And once they got to Medina, the immediate focus was building that first Islamic state and community. Building the mosque was fundamental. It wasn't just for prayer. It quickly became the community's, central hub for everything. And then establishing this brotherhood, the muwaqqat, between the muhajirun, the immigrants from Mecca, and the Ansar, the helpers in Medina.
Yeah, and this brotherhood, the work makes it clear, this wasn't just symbolic talk. It was a practical social revolution. It built real unity. It actively broke down those old, deep tribal divisions by making sure people supported each other, shared what they had, connected the strong and the weak. This practical unity really cut through traditional tribal biases and built a foundation for a completely new kind of society.
And as part of that foundation building, the Medina Charter was drafted, which, as the work notes, some researchers see as basically the world's first constitution, predating Magna Carta by, 600 years? It mainly sorted out relations between Muslims and Jews in Medina. What made it so revolutionary?
Well, its principles were just remarkably progressive for that time. Justice, mutual aid, collective defense if anyone attacked. And crucially, it guaranteed freedom of conscience. It specifically said Jews could join the community without being oppressed. And it included that line, "No one can believe without Allah's permission," which really underlines religious freedom. Plus, it set out shared duties. Like, you couldn't protect someone who acted against others in the treaty. And Jews had to fight alongside Muslims if Medina was attacked. It wasn't just rules. It was a blueprint for a pluralistic society.
Okay, so community and state established. The next phase is shaping that community. Early battles, consolidation. About 6 months after the Hijra, the Prophet starts forming armed groups, appointing leaders. This is the beginning of army building right after reverse permitted warfare.
Which leads straight to the Battle of Badr in 624 AD, the first big battle outside Medina fought during Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad leading about 313 Muslims against a much bigger Meccan force. And despite being way outnumbered, the Muslims won decisively. What's fascinating is how that victory, against those odds, just completely changed the power dynamic in Arabia. It solidified the early Muslim identity, gave them this huge morale boost, seen as divine proof. It's also the only battle named in the Quran. And fasting in Ramadan became obligatory right after this victory.
But then the Battle of Uhud in 625 AD, that was a setback, a tough defeat for the Muslims, mostly because some archers left their strategic posts to grab spoils, right? And Khalid ibn Walid, who was still fighting against the Muslims then, he jumped on that mistake. Led a devastating counterattack. So what was the big lesson there?
It was a really stark lesson in military discipline. Stick to your orders. The work highlights how that tactical blunder hammered home just how critical it was to maintain formation, follow instructions. It definitely shaped how they planned future battles. Then, a couple of years later, 627 AD, the Battle of the Trench. The Meccan polytheists, other tribes, even the Jewish Banu Nadir, they launched this massive attack on Medina. And the defense, digging a trench around the city. An idea from Salman al-Farsi, a Persian companion, it really threw the attackers off.
And the Jewish tribe Banu Qurayza, who were allied with the Muslims, they betrayed the pact during the siege.
Yeah.
But even with that treachery, the siege, the Quraysh didn't fully press their advantage, and the Muslims held out.
Indeed. That victory is often put down to divine help and also individual heroism, like Ali defeating a famous warrior in single combat. But the trench itself was brilliant strategy. It just canceled out the Meccans' numbers advantage and their siege tactics. It stalled them, forced them into a stalemate they just weren't ready for.
After these early fights, you see moves towards peace, but also more conquests. The Treaty of Hudaybiyah in 628 AD is a big one. It looked like a bad deal for the Muslims at first, but the Quran calls it a clear victory. How did that work? How did it pave the way for peaceful expansion?
It was pure diplomatic genius, really. The work emphasizes that by getting a 10-year truce and getting the Meccans to implicitly recognize the Muslim state, it just removed a huge barrier for Islam's spread. It shifted the whole game from fighting to talking, converting, interacting peacefully. The message could reach new people. And right after that, you get the conquest of Khaybar in 628 AD. This Jewish fortress, it had held out against other companions trying to take it. Ali was key here. Apparently displayed incredible strength, ripping a fortress gate off its hinges. The source suggests maybe divine strength was involved, like one man lifting what 70 struggled with.
Wow. And that victory led to a peace treaty. The Jews gave up the Fadak Gardens to the Prophet. And then the big one, the conquest of Mecca in 630 AD. Prophet Muhammad returns triumphant with a large army. He declares an end to polytheism, to blood feuds, and symbolically cleanses the Kaaba, gets rid of all the idols.
It was hugely symbolic. Bilal, who'd been a slave, climbing the Kaaba to give the call to prayer. It visually cemented the new reality, showed Islam's message of equality. This really was the fulfillment of one of the Prophet's biggest goals, bringing Mecca back spiritually and politically under Islam. Later that year, you also had the Battle of Hunain, another big Muslim victory against tribes near Taif.
Right. Now let's shift focus a bit to the Prophet's final years and his lasting legacy. The farewell pilgrimage in 632 AD, his first and last major Hajj, he meticulously taught everyone the rituals. And it was on this journey at a place called Ghadir Qum that he made this famous statement. Many sources, Shia definitely, but also some Sunni, connect this to designating Ali as his successor.
His death came later in 632 AD, after he'd been ill for a bit. He was buried very simply, just in his home in Medina. His whole life, the work consistently shows, was marked by extreme simplicity. Very clean, incredibly generous, really high moral standards. He ate little, always the last to leave the table to make sure everyone else had enough. That personal example was central to his leadership.
His marriages, especially after Khadija died, they often get misunderstood, don't they? He married several women, Sauda, Aisha, Hafsa, Salama, others. Our source really pushes back against the idea from some, you know, less objective Orientalists that these were just for pleasure. Can you give an example of the bigger picture?
Yeah, certainly. The work stresses the main goals were strategic, building unity between different Arab tribes, neutralizing potential enemies, and also providing for widows and orphans of Muslims killed in battle. Like his marriage to Juwairiyah, it helped pacify her powerful tribe, turned enemies into allies. That's smart state building through diplomacy. It's also worth remembering he only had one son later, Ibrahim, from Maria al-Qibtiyya, and tragically, he died as an infant.
Okay, this brings us to a really key concept in the work. The Ahl al-Bayt, the people of the house. Primarily Ali, Fatima, Hassan, and Hussein. The work emphasizes their incredible knowledge, not just religion, but language, literature, even chemistry and philosophy. Like Arabic grammar is said to come from Ali. And Jabir ibn Hayyan, a huge figure in early chemistry, supposedly learned it from Imam Jafar Sadiq.
And the Prophet's deep love and respect for them, it comes up again and again in the sources. It highlights their special status, the reverence they held. You have those famous sayings, I am the city of knowledge and Ali is its gate, or whoever loves Fatima will be with me in paradise. It's also said, first to enter paradise after me are Ali and Fatima. It just underscores their unique place, their deep spiritual link to the Prophet.
So after the Prophet passed away, the Rashidun Caliphate begins, and straight away, challenges over succession, governance. Abu Bakr becomes the first caliph, 602 to 634 AD.
And one significant event right at the start was the Fadak dispute. Fatima, the Prophet's daughter, she claimed her inheritance, including those Fadak gardens we mentioned. But Abu Bakr denied it. He cited a hadith. We prophets don't leave inheritance. Whatever we leave behind is charity. Now, regarding Abu Bakr's reasoning here, the source points out a perspective that, well, found this interpretation difficult, especially given Fatima's previous ownership and the Prophet's known love for her. The logic, it notes, wasn't immediately clear in this specific situation.
Politically, though, Abu Bakr did successfully deal with false prophets and tribes that tried to break away. That was vital for holding the new Islamic state together. He also started major campaigns against the Byzantines, setting things up for the Battle of Yarmouk, and began the conquest of Iraq.
Next up was Umar. Caliph from 634 to 644 AD. Interestingly, he'd been an enemy of Islam, converted around 616. His time saw huge expansion. much of Persia Azerbaijan conquered. But what's really key is he set up administrative systems, notably the Diwan. This was like a public register, a bureau, set up to systematically manage soldiers' pay and rations, a massive step in formalizing state bureaucracy. He also set up the first treasury, the first prison, tragically assassinated in 644 AD by a Persian slave.
After Umar, Uthman becomes caliph, 644 to 656 AD, elected by that six-person council Umar set up. The Banu Umayya tribe was key in his election. His reign continued the expansion to Tunisia, Transcaucasia, Azerbaijan, Khorasan, Sindh, big territories, and he oversaw the first major naval victory against the Byzantines.
But his assassination by rebels in 656 AD, that was a massive turning point. It kicked off years of terrible civil war within the caliphate. The work mentions his blood supposedly fell on a Quran copy, and many Qurans today are still called Uthman Qurans.
Which brings us to the Caliphate of Ali. 656 to 661 AD, born in the Kaaba itself, raised by the Prophet, and many sources, especially Shia, but some Sunni too, point to that Ghadir Qum event we talked about as a divine appointment, Ali as successor. He actually refused the caliphate for 5 days at first, before finally accepting.
Yeah, and his time as caliph was sadly just dominated by internal conflict. First, the Battle of the Camel, 656 AD, fought against Aisha, Tal, Zubair. They blamed Ali for Uthman's death. Ali won, but thousands of Muslims died fighting each other.
Then the really long, bloody Battle of Siffin in 657 AD against Muawiyah, the governor of Syria. He wouldn't pledge allegiance to Ali, wanted revenge for Uthman. The work mentions a night of howling from the sound of the wounded. That's such a stark image. Really highlights the awful cost of this internal fighting, doesn't it?
It really does. And what's fascinating is the arbitration that came out of it, which led to this major split. Muawiyah pulled this clever trick, raising Quran pages on spears, calling for arbitration. Ali's army split over it. And the arbitration, well, it ended up favoring Muawiyah, who then just declared himself caliph in Syria. This then forced Ali to fight the Qarijites, the ones who broke away after the arbitration at the Battle of Nahrawan in 658. They declared both Ali and Muawiyah infidels. Ali predicted how many of his own men would die versus how many Qarijites, and apparently he was spot on. Most Qarijites were killed, but about 10 escaped, including Abd al-Rahman ibn Muljam.
Despite all that chaos, Ali was known for his incredible knowledge, his military skill, his simple, devoted life. But in the end, he too was assassinated. By that same Abd al-Rahman ibn Muljam, poisoned sword during morning prayers in the mosque, 661 AD. His tomb is widely believed to be in Najaf, Iraq.
Right. The story then moves into this period of real tragedy and transformation. Karbala, the rise of the Umayyads. After Ali, his son Hassan became caliph. He's the second imam in Shia theology. He became caliph after Ali died, but he ended up making peace with Muawiyah. Reports say he was under huge pressure, faced betrayal.
And tragically, the work states Muawiyah then had Imam Hassan poisoned. After promising Hassan's wife a huge sum of money in marriage to his own son Yazid, a promise Muawiyah apparently never intended to keep. It just underscores his reputation for, well, cunning and ignoring agreements when it suited him. And it was Muawiyah who set up the Umayyad Caliphate. This was a fundamental shift. Power became dynastic inherited, moving away from that earlier consultative idea. The work paints him as cunning, yeah, willing to break agreements. He even ordered Ali to be cursed publicly from pulpits. That practice went on until Umar ibn Abdulaziz, around 717 AD. He also apparently poisoned other key figures, like Malik al-Ashtar. And most controversially, he named his son Yazid as his successor, a move that really flew in the face of Islamic tradition.
Which brings us to Yazid's caliphate. Our source describes him as pretty indulgent. Lavish parties, music, wine apparently became common during his rule. And then the terrible tragedy of Karbala. Imam Hussein, Ali and Fatima's second son, born 626 AD, he refused to pledge allegiance to Yazid. He saw Yazid as morally corrupt, deviating from Islamic principles.
He'd been invited to Kufa by people there, promising support, but they famously betrayed him later. Our source mentions Prophet Muhammad actually prophesied Hussein's martyrdom, even repped when he was born, and the event itself. 10th of Muharram, October 680 AD, Hussein, his family, his companions, brutally martyred by Yazid's army at Karbala. There's a heartbreaking detail in the work. His four-year-old daughter, Ruqayya, died of grief after seeing her father's severed head.
It's also said the actual earth from Hussein's grave is considered sacred, a source of blessing, unlike other earth. And the impact of Karbala was immediate. and huge, widespread outrage. It left this deep scar on the Muslim conscience.
Yeah, it led to revolts. Like the Battle of Al-Hara in 682 AD, Yazid's army crushed a revolt in Medina, massacred people, desecrated the Prophet's tomb. The outcome was so awful, children born from the rapes during that event were called Banu Hara people. It's a grim marker of just how bad things got.
And right after that, 683 AD, Yazid's forces besieged Mecca, burned half the city, parts of the Kaaba even, before news finally arrived that Yazid himself had died. The work really highlights these awful actions committed by people claiming to be Muslims. It just shows this profound moral decline, massive political instability.
Karbala definitely sparked a chain reaction of revolts. You had the Tawaban, the penitents in Kufa. They rose up wanting revenge for Hussein, basically martyred themselves fighting. Then Mukhtar Thaqafi took up the cause. He executed many of Hussein's killers, figures like Shamir Dual Jashan, Ibn Ziyad, Umar Ibn Saad. These reprisals show that deep need for justice Karbala had unleashed.
And ultimately, yes, the Karbala tragedy was a huge factor, a major catalyst for the Abbasid uprising in 750 AD. That's what finally brought down the Umayyad Caliphate. That revolution really fed on the widespread anger and discontent over what the Umayyads had done, especially against the Alal Bayt, and how far they seem to have strayed from Islamic ideals.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? This deep dive into early Islamic history, looking through that unique lens of Azerbaijani researchers comparing their work with Arabic sources. It really shows you just how complex this founding era was.
Yeah, what's really striking is seeing how fast a spiritual movement through, you know, smart leadership and things like the Medina Charter turned into a powerful state. But then, as we've seen almost right away, it faced these huge internal battles over who should lead, over justice. We've kind of tracked that journey from tribal division to a unified community, seen how ideas like brotherhood were actually put into practice, and understood the impact of those key battles.
And we've definitely seen the massive impact of individuals and the choices they made, from the Prophet's own moral example to the political games and devastating conflicts after he passed away. Which kind of leaves us with a big question today, doesn't it? How do the echoes of these early events, especially that tension between religious ideals and political reality, how do they still shape societies, belief systems all over the world? Understanding this rich, often turbulent period, it's not just about memorizing dates and names. It's about really grasping that ongoing tension between faith, power, and, well, human nature. Maybe consider what lessons from this early history really stick with you and how they might connect to the world we're living in right now.